Rabbi Kelman said that I'm an expert on Rashbam. I'm this commentator from the 12th century, and I guess it is true that I've written quite a bit about Rashbam, and I've got an attraction to the Torah commentary of Rashbam. I think that if I had my academic life to live over again, I might have taught myself Italian and become an expert on Samuel David Luzzatto, on Shadal. And I'm extremely attracted intellectually to the work that was done by Shadal. I'll try to convey a little bit about this evening about why I'm so excited about Shadal's work. We have a lot of texts. We might not get through all of these texts, but we'll look at some of these texts, and I'll try to paint an intellectual picture of Shadal. I've only written in my academic career, I've only written one third of one article that dealt with Shadal, because I just feel funny, because like half of his works are closed to me because he wrote in Italian. And in fact, in a biography of Shadal that I read recently, it said that his Hebrew, he was known for clear and simple Hebrew style, and many people see him as someone who led to the recreation of Hebrew. He was a great lover of the Hebrew language, to the recreation of Hebrew as a language that people could study. Maybe I'll just begin by jumping out of order. Look at text number 11 on page 3 here. Rabbi Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, a contemporary of Shadal, and the person who is normally seen as the founder of Neo-Orthodoxy, one time sent a letter to Shadal, and he wrote it in German. And of course, Shadal was an extremely well-educated person, and German was the language of scholarship in those days. And Hirsch correctly assumed that Shadal could read German, but Shadal was just flabbergasted. You know, it would be kind of like me today if I were writing a letter to a rabbi in Italy and saying, well, he's university educated, so I would assume that he could read English, so I'd send it in English. And usually a rabbi in one country sending a letter to a learned Jew in another country would write it in Hebrew. And so Shadal wrote this little ditty here. Ma hayalo leval igrot safon. What happened to the author of the 19 letters? This is a philosophical work of Hirsch. Hanefach liot Geiger Holdheim? Did he turn into Abraham Geiger? Did he turn into Samuel Holdheim, these leaders of the Reform movement? Ki yichtov leShadal b'lashon haTzafon. He wrote a letter to Shadal in German. V'lo b'sfat Yehuda v'Yerushalayim, and not in the language of Jews, the language of Yehuda and Yerushalayim. So he was a great lover of Hebrew, wrote beautiful Hebrew, clear Hebrew. It's really easy to understand. You compare it to other 19th century writers. His Hebrew, I remember the first time I opened up Shadal, I was certain that I was reading a 20th century author, and then I learned that he was living actually in the beginning of the 19th century. However, I'm told that his Italian is flowery and difficult, and so, you know, it would take a lot of years of studying Italian in order to really be able to turn into a scholar of Shadal. Dr. Nussbaum just told me as we were walking in that when he first came to New York and he was considering studying in the Beit Midrash Lemorim, the teacher's seminary associated with Yeshiva University, that their hero was Shadal. And Shadal was an extremely well-educated both from a Jewish perspective and from a secular perspective. He had finished studying finished studying the Babylonian Talmud when he was 17 years old. His Gemara teacher offered to give him smicha. Then when he was 17 years old, he turned it down. He said he did not want to. He's one of these people who had sufficient knowledge to be a rabbi. There's a whole category of people who certainly had sufficient knowledge to be a rabbi but did not want to have the title of rabbi. He ended up being the head of a rabbinical school, kind of in the way that, like, Richard Joel now could be the head of Yeshiva University, even though Richard Joel is not a rabbi. So it wasn't necessary for Shadal to have the title of rabbi in order to be the head of the rabbinical school in Padua. I think that since I made that comparison, I should make it clear that his salary was not anything like the salary that Richard Joel gets as the president of Yeshiva University. In fact, he had great difficulty making a living. He had a very difficult life. His mother died when he was very young. His two older brothers died when he was very young. A number of his children predeceased him. I forget whether it was two or three children of his who died while Shadal was still alive, and he was sickly for much of his life. The gene pool in that family was not great, and he died, they say, penniless and blind. So it wasn't a happy life story for Shadal. He was an extremely productive scholar, and the only book that I'm going to talk about of his at any length here is his commentary on the Torah, which is what has always attracted me. But he was also a Jewish thinker who wrote books of Jewish philosophy. He saw mercy as the essence of what Judaism was about. And he said that much of the Torah is built on the assumption that we are merciful people and trying to kind of take advantage of the fact that we do feel mercy for other human beings and for other creatures, also for animals too, and trying to increase the amount of mercy that we feel towards other human beings. And that's the purpose of the Torah, is to develop that mercy instinct that human beings have inside of them. And much of his attempt at ta'amei mitzvot, at explaining the reasons for mitzvot, is trying to explain how everything really comes down to chemla, comes down to compassion, comes down to mercy. But he lived in a very interesting time when the times of Haskalah, of enlightenment, times when biblical criticism was being created and developed, and times when Reformed Judaism was being created and developed. He was strongly against Reform Judaism, although we'll see a really interesting line in the continuation of the text here that relates to the reform of Judaism. But the movement called Reform Judaism with a capital R, he was a strong opponent of it from his youth, writing essays against it. And his attitude towards new ways of studying the Bible is what really attracts me. And it's controversial, and it might not attract you. You might not like it. You might not think that it's orthodox, either with a small O or a capital O. Some people said that Shadal didn't leave a lot of students behind because the modernists and the reformers all thought that he was too old-fashioned because he was Shomer Mitzvot. He observed the Mitzvot. And the Shomer Mitzvot, the observant people thought that he was just a little bit heterodox in his understanding. Some of you know me might not now understand why I'm kind of attracted to this personality. He took unpopular stance about many issues, including he was a strong spokesman against Jewish mysticism. He did not like mysticism. And in his, I never read this book because it was written in Italian, but he has a 4-volume autobiography written in Italian. And the first volume, I don't know, I read sometime that it was like 300 pages long, and it describes his life until age 12. And I'm tempted to learn Italian just to see what it is that somebody could say about their life. So, you know, I think that if I had to write about my life till age 12, could I come up with one paragraph that would that would interest people? But his life was perhaps more interesting and more complex than mine before he turned 12 years old, and he had lost his mother by that point. And he talks about the big fights that he had with his family, that his family wanted him to be reciting Kabbalistic prayers for the healing of his mother. And he, you know, he was an expert understander of Hebrew and Aramaic by that point, and he looked at these prayers and he didn't want to say them. And in this biography of his in Hebrew that I read, it says that he got all upset. He said, "People think that I didn't love my mother sufficiently, and that's why I didn't say these prayers. But when she was sick and she was throwing up and she was in bed and she was dirty, I was the only one who was there taking care of her. But I just didn't want to say prayers that I didn't believe in." And he also was perhaps the strongest writer of the opinion that said that the Zohar could not have been written by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. That's the standard traditional attribution of the Zohar. And he had some fascinating proofs, including the fact, one of my favorite proofs from Shaddal about how the Zohar could not be an ancient work, is that the Ta'amei HaMikra, the cantillation signs, the trop signs, are discussed and in the Zohar, and significance is given to them and to the shape of these signs, like the Zarka, the sign that looks like a snake that appears on top of some words in the Torah. In the Zohar, sometimes talks about, well, the reason that there is a Zarka on top of this word is because of the allusion to snakes. And Shaddal proved that in the earliest years of the cantillation signs, first of all, in the days of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, there were no cantillation signs on the text. And second of all, in the earliest years of cantillation signs, a zarka was not shaped like a snake. He went through manuscripts and proved that in the earliest days. So he said it has to be somebody from the 11th, 12th, 13th century who's writing this. And so, you know, he took these unpopular kinds of positions, but he was the head of an Orthodox rabbinical school and a great scholar of traditional Judaism. Are there any questions about my introduction before I go to looking at little texts? I'd be happy to be interrupted if anybody has any questions. I'm gonna. Yes, please. I don't think he liked mysticism very much. I think that he was a very spiritual person. But I don't think that he liked mysticism. I don't think that he liked the system of the Sfirot. He thought that it was a foreign implant in Judaism, and he thought that in some ways, you know, he sometimes sounds to me like a Hasid because of his spirituality. But he did not like the system of Jewish mysticism. So I'm just going to race through various texts here, pointing out the anomaly of this kind of approach. That are there any more copies of the handout around? Okay. Okay. So Chagall does various things that standard Orthodox people don't do. For example, in text number one here, he says about the phrase Yira'e kol zuchurcha, all of your males shall be seen. That's the way the text is vocalized in Hebrew in the Tanakh. He says, well, actually, it should read Yir'e kol zuchurcha. That the verse is Shalosh pa mim bashana Yera'e kol zuchurcha ad pnei Hashem. Three times every year, all of your males should be seen in Jerusalem. And he says what a number of scholars would say about here. I'll just read you like the official Art Scroll translation of that verse. Three times a year, all your males shall appear before the Lord Hashem, the God of Israel. Yera'eh kol zuchurcha et pnei ha'adon Hashem Elokei Yisrael. He says that actually the original text here was Yir'eh kol zuchurcha. All of your males shall see the face of the Lord God. And that people felt that this was overly anthropomorphic, and it was toned down by the Masoretes, the idea of the males coming and seeing the face of God. He says, but obviously from a grammatical point of view, just looking at these Hebrew letters and these Hebrew words, the only way these words make any sense is to say that the original text here was read, they shall all see the face of God, which he says is not doesn't have to be understood anthropomorphically. You know, there are texts in the Bible that talk about God's arm and God's legs and God's eyes, and if we can interpret those and say that they are metaphorical, this also can be interpreted metaphorically, but he said it was toned down by the Masoretes. So this isn't quite an emendation of the consonantal text, of the consonants of the Torah, but this is coming darn close. And every once in a while in his commentary, he shows that, he's willing to consider other readings of the consonantal text too. One of the hardest verses in the Torah. You know, I can read it to you in the translation here, but no one really knows precisely what this verse means. And what one will buy from the Levites, a house that has been sold, or the city of its ancestral heritage, shall go out in the Jubilee year for the. He points out at the beginning of the comment, I'm not going to read through the whole thing, but you can look through it yourself if you wish. Uva Targum Romi in the Vulgate, Katuv Asher Lo Yigal, that it's, instead of saying Asher Yigal, that which shall be bought, it says that which shall not be bought. I once was having a conversation with somebody in this room whom I won't identify by name, and I asked, when editing, what's the worst word that you could possibly forget to put into a text? What's the, that person answered, the word not, of course. When you leave out the word not, it changes the verse entirely. And he gives this long explanation why what it says in the Vulgate, the reading in the Vulgate makes more sense than the reading in the Masoretic text. And then at the end, he says, the Kach Rashbam Hirgisha HaKavanak Shelo. Rashbam didn't actually amend the text, but Rashbam commented on this. Rashbam's comment is also extremely difficult to understand. The verse isn't difficult to understand. But all that I'm trying to show is that he had a willingness to, when dealing with a difficult verse, look at other versions. Look, in the Vulgate, the Latin translation, they translated as if the word lo was there in the verse. We don't have that inside of our Torah. Well, works a little better with that word lo in the text. Chagall offered. Please, please.
Is he claiming it was there and it was lost in over time, or it was never there but it should be read at the right time?
He doesn't say anything. He doesn't. He just says, you know, so here's what the traditionalist says, say, but you should know that in the Vulgate, they translate as if the word lo was there, and then the word, then the verse means the following. It's just, you know, he's not establishing any facts about what actually happened here, but he's just, he's entertaining that. And you and I both know, Rabbi Kelman, that, you know, in most Orthodox circles, people don't, like, entertain the possibility of reading it differently, and let's say, but of course this is Narishkeit, this reading and the traditional reading, but that's not how he finishes this comment. He's willing to entertain that possibility, especially when looking at a difficult verse like this. On the famous phrase, text number 3, talking about the phrase Na'aseh v'nishma, which was always a central phrase in Jewish thinking, in Jewish philosophy. We will do and we will hear. In other words, first of all, we take it upon ourselves that we will observe the mitzvot of the Torah, and later on we'll try to figure them out. We'll try to understand the idea behind them, the idea that we don't wait to observe a mitzvah until we've understood the meaning of it. That understanding of the phrase goes back to the days of the Gemara and has been constant through Jewish history. And then Shatal comes along and says, actually, that isn't what the words Na'aseh v'nishma mean. When the Jewish people heard that they were receiving Torah, and they said, Kol asher diber Hashem Na'aseh v'nishma, everything that God is telling us Na'aseh v'nishma, he says, well, there are two kinds of mitzvot come in two kinds. Mitzvot aseh and mitzvot lo taseh, things that you're supposed to do and things that you're supposed to refrain from doing. And na'aseh v'nishma means the things that we're supposed to do, we will do, and the things that we are supposed to refrain from doing, nishma, we will listen. So the people said, we will observe the positive commandments, we will do what the positive commandments ask us to do, and we will refrain. We will listen to the negative commandments, and we won't do those things that we're not supposed to do. One of my heroes, Professor Uriel Simon from the Bible Department of Bar-Ilan University, once wrote an essay about Pshat and Rash, and he said, there is no doubt that Shadal is right, that that's what the words actually mean of Na'aseh v'nishma, but you should never teach this to a class of kids in a Jewish school. You know, kids in a Jewish school should learn that Na'aseh v'nishma means that first of all you do, because that's Judaism. That's what we've been teaching for all of these years. So although Professor Simon is one of the biggest fans of Pshat alive today, in this essay about Pshat and Rashi, he says that there's a limit to the use of Pshat. You know, once somebody becomes the age of university students, or some of us in the room here are even older than university students, then you can tell them about things like this. But Pshat, I have a lecture that I sometimes give called The Dangers of Pshat, and this is dangerous in a certain sense, because it's undermining an important traditional Jewish understanding of the verse. I'm going to skip text number 4. Those of you who can read the Hebrew can read it yourself on your own, and just talk about what I find one of the most interesting and daring things that Shadal does in his commentary on the Torah. And just as a few words of introduction, there are three kinds of approaches to what does a rabbi do what does a commentator do when he finds that there's tension between what he thinks the words of the Bible mean and what the halakha says that those words of the Bible mean. So, generally speaking, I would say that there are three kinds of approaches. Approach number one, well, I guess there is an approach that doesn't make it to my list here, which says, forget about Pshat, don't look at it. Pshat, don't look at the simple meaning of the text, it's totally unimportant. But if you value the pshat, and you value the halakha. And of course, there's the other radical approach that says, don't pay any attention to what the halakha says. But we're talking about people. What do people like Rashi or Rashbam or Ibn Ezra or Shaddal do when they find the tension between what they think that the words of the biblical text are saying and what the halakha says that a Jew is supposed to do because of that verse? So approach number one, I would call the approach that's used by Rashi and Rashbam, which says, okay, the pshat tells us what the words mean at kind of the first level of analysis. But then we look to see if there are any superfluous words in the text. And if there are any superfluous words in the text, then it's kind of a red flag that says to us, you should be adding some meaning here. And Midrash is based on the red flags from the identifying superfluous words in the text. So that's what I call approach number one to solving this tension. Approach number two to solving this tension is the approach that was made famous by Abraham Ibn Ezra, who says, the pshat is what the Bible really means. Halakha is not based on interpretation of the Bible. Halakha is based on oral Torah, on oral traditions that are passed along. And then at some point in history, rabbis took those oral traditions and they attached it artificially to the biblical text, not as interpretation of the biblical text, but pretty well as a mnemonic device. Ibn Ezra doesn't give this example, but I'll give the example here just because it's a simple thing to understand. So, you know, how did we get from don't boil a kid in its mother's milk to the entire system of kosher laws? So approach number one would say, well, because it's written three times in the Torah, then it's kind of superfluous. The second time and the third time, it's superfluous. So that's a red flag for us, and that means that we should expand it beyond just boiling a kid in its mother's milk. That's how we learn to expand it. Ibn Ezra might say, he doesn't actually say it on this example, and one day, if I'm talking about Ibn Ezra, I could say why he doesn't use this example. But an Ibn Ezra kind of approach might say here, the tradition of not eating meat and milk went back to Har Sinai, went back to Mount Sinai, but it wasn't attached to the biblical text. And this was oral Torah. This was part of the ancient Jewish tradition. And then somebody once decided, well, okay, that this verse about boiling a kid in its mother's milk is darn close to not eating meat and milk together. And so we'll take that tradition and we'll attach it to the verse, even though it doesn't come from that verse. So that's the second way of dealing with the tension. And the third way of dealing with it is Shaddal's approach, which is a daring new approach. Give you a few examples of this approach instead of just characterizing it. So there is a verse in Exodus 21 talking about damages that are done between animals or damage that is done to animals. If a man uncovers a pit, or if a man digs a pit and doesn't cover it up, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make restitution. He shall return money to its owner. So I dig a pit somewhere in public property, and people were expected in the ancient world to be taking their animals through the street, and I make a hole right in the middle of the street, and somebody's donkey falls into the hole. He shall return money to its owner, and the carcass shall be his. Whose? Who does the carcass? Hamet ye lo. So in the carcass shall be his. There's a discussion in the oldest texts about what that actually means. So, Shaddal says, and he follows Rashbam here, Rashbam says, it means that I'm the one who dug this pit. Your donkey was damaged. I pay you for your donkey, and I get a dead donkey. And I think that that's a good reading of the text. I get to take away the dead donkey, and I pay you the price of a live donkey. So Rashbam says that's what the text means, but Rashbam mentions that's not what the rabbis say in the Gemara. That the rabbis say in the Gemara that I'm allowed to say to Sue, you see this dead donkey of yours here? It's yours. And let's now measure how much a dead donkey is worth and how much a live donkey is worth. And if we say that a live donkey is worth $1,000 and a dead donkey is worth $50, then I'll give you $950, but and I'm also allowed to pay you the dead donkey. That's the halachic conclusion of what those words hamet yelo actually mean. But it just doesn't look that way from reading the verse. And so see what Shadal writes here. He says that actually the verse means, as Rashbam said, says that it means that the person who caused the damage is stuck with the dead donkey. And then he writes, V'razal hekelu al hamazik, v'amru she'eno chayav l'shalem lo kesef mamash v'yachol l'shalem lo b'chol davar v'afilu subin, v'lefichach maniach lo hanevela, u'mashalem lo b'chol ma sha'achai shaveh yoter min hanevela. What we have here is an example of rabbinic legislation, not an example of rabbinic interpretation of those words, v'hamet yelo, but the rabbis are legislators here. And they wanted to make it easier for a person who has caused damages to repay the damages. And they say, you can use, and you don't have to use, you know, and I assume that in the court of, in the courts of Ontario, if they come up with some ruling against me and say that I owe Sue $1,000, I'm not allowed to pay her with boxes of Kellogg's Corn Flakes or with you know, with something that's worth $1,000 or with dead donkeys. But the rabbis wanted to make it easier for people to pay back the damages that they caused. Obviously, the person didn't cause this damage directly. And so this is legislation as opposed to interpretation. That the rabbis had a reason for abandoning the pshat, because they thought that, you know, even though the Bible didn't say this, they thought this would be a good rule for their society. I'm going to skip through various texts. Maybe I'll look at example 7 here. I'll skip past 6. I'll look at example 7. Example 7 here deals with the problem of what appears to be a contradiction between what happened in Deuteronomy and what happened in Exodus, and talking about the Korban Pesach, the Paschal sacrifice. In Exodus, it says, "Set tamim zachar ben shana yelachem min hakvasim u'min ha'izim tikachu." The Paschal sacrifice should be a sheep, or it should be a goat, either one of those. And then verse 8 says, "There v'achlu at basar balayla zetzli eshu matzot al merorim yochluhu." You should eat the Paschal sacrifice roasted. Verse 9 says, "Al tochlu imenu na'u v'ashel mushal b'mayim." You're not allowed to eat it cooked. It isn't. You're not allowed to boil it. It has to be roasted. So that's what it says in Exodus. Then it says in Deuteronomy, verse 2 at the top of the page, here, "V'zavachta Pesach l'Hashem Elokecha tzon u'bakar." Should offer a Paschal sacrifice to God, either sheep or cattle, from the cow family also. It's not the same thing that it said in Exodus. And then verse 7 says, "Uvishalta va'achalta b'makom asher yivchar Hashem Elokecha bo." And you shall levashel. You should cook it, boil it. The precise thing that it says in Shmot that you're not allowed to do, it says in Deuteronomy that that's what you should be doing. Now, it's true, I think that the standard rabbinic harmonization here is not a problematic harmonization. It is true that the word levashel in Hebrew, the verb levashel in Hebrew, can mean both to boil and it can mean to cook. It can be the generic word for cooking. You could talk about bishul, meaning cooking, which would include in it roasting as a form of bishul. That's the standard harmonization. But it's jarring that Shmot says you're not allowed bishul, you're not allowed to boil it, and then Deuteronomy says, and then ubishalta v'achalta, then you should bashal it and eat it. So this problem was noticed, of course, immediately after the Bible was finished, and in fact, there's a very strong argument to suggest that the author of the Book of Chronicles of Divrei Hayamim in the Bible knew about this problem between Exodus and Deuteronomy and tried to solve it in a verse. There was a book written recently about interbiblical interpretation, and I think that's one of the excellent examples, a verse towards the end of the Book of Chronicles that says they bashaled the Pesach in fire and they bashaled a different sacrifice in a pot. So he's trying to solve the problem between the two uses of the word bashal. And as I said, we know from modern Hebrew that, you know, levashel can mean to boil, and it can also mean just to be a general word for cooking, so maybe it's not such a big problem. But Shadal comes up with this whole history of what happened. Exodus is talking about what was happening at that first Pesach when we were there in Egypt. And then there were specific rules that it was supposed to be from a sheep and it was supposed to be roasted. And can anybody think of a reason why it might be a good idea for it to be roasted and for it to be a sheep in that original Passover in Egypt? Because the whole theme of Exodus chapter 12 is that it's supposed to be done quickly. The theme of chipazon, that you have to be able to leave Egypt quickly. So to roast or to cook an entire cow takes a long time. So you take a smaller animal, you take a sheep or a goat, and you roast it, which is the fastest way of cooking. And so Shadal says, obviously, that was what was supposed to be done when they were in Egypt. And then for future generations, Deuteronomy is talking about future generation celebration of Pesach. And they say, you want a sheep? Fine. You want a goat? Fine. You want a cow? Fine. You want to roast it? Fine. You want to boil it? Fine. Now, of course, what's the problem with this? It's against halacha. Yes, halacha says that in future years, the Korban Pesach has to... But Shadal's looking at the words here, and he thinks that that's the simplest solution with the words. But then how to explain where halacha ended up where it is? So at the end of his text, he says, "Va'afal pichein," even though that's the meaning of the text, "Nahagu kadmonenu lohosif zecher liyitziat Mitzrayim ulavi minatzon bilvad, our forefathers decided it would be nice to do it the way that our original forefathers had done it on that original Pesach night in Egypt. And so this was like a decision of the Jewish people to do this. But don't see this as interpretation of the text in Deuteronomy. This is too far-fetched an interpretation of the text. And so we'll follow this because the Jewish people voted, you know, if he were lived a few years later and had known Solomon Schechter, he might have said, Catholic Israel has decided, Klal Yisrael decided that that's the way they wanted to do it, even though the Torah allowed them to bring a paschal sacrifice that would be a cow and that they would boil. The Jewish people decided to take upon themselves. And there are many examples like this where he solves the tension between the pshat, the simple meaning of the text, and the halakha by saying there was a later process that caused. Usually, it's the rabbis as legislators, and usually it's the rabbis taking. He argues that there seems to be a theme that in rabbinic interpretation, the rabbis, they must have known what the simple meaning of the biblical text was, but they decided to make it more lenient. Example 6 at the bottom of the page is like that. It's a little too complicated to go into it. I see that I'm running out of time, so I won't give it. But it's, again, an example of the rabbis, in his understanding, offering a lenient understanding of the text, and not because they're seeing it as interpretation, but because they are lenient, because they want to be lenient leaders of the people. And the kind of programmatic statement of his is here in text number 8, where he kind of describes, like, what is it that the rabbis are doing? He writes here in text number 8, "Acharei kama shanim shaiti matmiya al razal." It's many years now that I've been wondering about the Talmudic rabbis. Lama kedivei Rashbam. Why did they, as Rashbam once put it, akru hakatuv hazeh mipshuto? They took this verse. It doesn't matter what this verse is, but Rashbam writes about this specific verse in Vayikra. Chachamim akruhu mipshuto. The rabbis totally ignored the plain meaning of this text. So Shatal knows that Rashbam is right. And just because I mentioned Rashbam, let me just mention that one of the frustrating things about studying Rashbam is that when Rashbam points out the tension between the halakha and what he sees as the plain meaning of the text, he never helps you resolve that tension. He never offers a theory to explain. He can only speculate about what it meant in his mind, about how he reconciled it in his mind. You're sitting there waiting for that next line, and he doesn't give it to you. So Shadal is giving you a theory about how this happened. So why did they take the simple meaning of the text and totally ignore the simple meaning of the text? Hayom, today, Purim, Tafresh Zayin. Today, Purim 1847. You know, this is what he's doing on Purim. He's sitting there worrying about the tension between Pshat and Halacha. So today, Purim in 1847, that is right, 47, yes, 1847. Zachiti lahavin mara'u al kach. A little allusion here to a line from the book of Esther. Now I understand what they were doing. V'chein b'chol makom shenatu razal mipshat haktuvim. Whenever the rabbis ignored the plain meaning of the biblical text. She'en hadavar da'at hayachid. I'm not talking about when it's just one person who does it, but when it was the total of rabbinic tradition ignoring the plain meaning of the biblical text. Aval hu davar muskam b'li cholek. When it's the rabbinic tradition is unanimous in zeh. Einenu ta'ut she'ta'u. This isn't because of a mistake. It isn't because of their inability to read the plain meaning of the biblical text. Aval hu takana she'tiknu l'fi tzora chadorot. It's because the rabbis were legislators. You know, they saw what the Torah said, but they felt that actually right now it's hard to implement that law in that way. And so we're going to understand it in a different way. And here's my favorite phrase. Umi kamohem reformator. Where can you find Reform Jews, the reformers like the rabbis of the Talmud? Just that they saw what the Bible said, but they saw what was appropriate for their generation, and they interpreted it for their generation. Aval, I told you in the beginning, he was not a fan of Reform Judaism. Aval, takanotehem hayu b'chokhma amuka uviyirat Hashem va'ahavat ha'adam. But all of their changes were made with deep wisdom. They were made with the fear of God, and they were made with the love of other human beings. He's suggesting that he doesn't think that the changes being made by the reformers were, in his days, were had a similar motivation. Lo lahana'at atzmam o lichvodam, velo limtso chen be'enei basar vadam. Their changes were not made for their own personal benefits, for their own personal honor, and not in order to find favor in the eyes of other people, suggesting, as many Orthodox critics of Reform Judaism were suggesting in the 19th century, that reforms were being initiated in order to make it simpler for Jews to blend into non-Jewish society, to limtso chen ve'enei basar vadam, so that other people will look at us, so the non-Jews will look at us in a more positive way. At the bottom of this page, of page two, we find yet another example of Shadal offering a kind of sweeping statement about the laws of the Torah. The law here is the law that says that a man who curses his mother or father shall surely die. Shadal writes, "Bimei kedem haya ha'av shalit beveito la'anosh u'lahamit kamo sheyadua midivrei hayamim shel ha'umot." In antiquity, of course, any parent could kill any child of his, could punish, include by killing any child of his who he thought had misbehaved. We know this from our studies of other cultures. V'nei ha'Torah natla ha'shilton hazeh min ha'av u'natanatu le'beit din. And the Torah took that power away from parents and said, oh, you got problems with your children? Take them to the court. And the court will deal with them. But it looks here like the Torah is dealing with them pretty pretty strictly by saying that if you curse your parent, you will surely die. Omnam Hashoftim ein safek shehayu notim lahakel al pi ma shemasar lahem Moshe ba'al peh. But without any doubt, the judges didn't implement the law the way it's written here. Moshe gave oral instructions to the judges. He wanted the law to be here on the book so it would scare the kids. If you curse your parent. I remember the first time that I was sitting in shul, sitting beside my father when they read the Ben Sorer Umoreh, and I saw that the parents had the right to take the rebellious child to the gate of the city and to have him stoned and killed. I think that I was scared, and I may have behaved better for maybe 10 minutes or so after the first time that I understood that. There's a rhetorical function to having texts like this in the Torah, but obviously Moshe provided oral instructions to judges, and he told them that you shouldn't apply it this way. We can find it in the Talmud. Talmud suddenly says that cursing a parent means cursing a parent and invoking the four-letter name of God, the Tetragrammaton, Yud Hey Vav Hey, in that curse. So that's a lot of restrictions. Not that many children may curse their parents, but not that many of them invoke the name Yud Hey Vav Hey when they curse a parent. V'dugmaze ben sorer umoreh. This is just like the story of the rebellious son in Deuteronomy. Gam sham hitzrichu razal tnaim rabim. There also the rabbis insisted that there would be many conditions. Ad shemitato krova l'nimna, till killing a rebellious child becomes virtually impossible. V'ze omnam klal gadol. Here's the principle. Harbe mishpatim tzrichim lehe'amer derech gizum v'iyum. Many things have to be written in strong language in order to preserve their educational value. Mibli sheyitztak lehotziam lafoal ela bitnaim she'ein metziutam krova. And we're actually going to implement these rules extremely rarely, only in extremely unusual kinds of circumstances. Udrayim elu tzarich sheyu nimsarim leshoftim beseter. But the legal system only works if you inform the judges secretly about these things. You can't write this in the book. You can't say in the book, you will surely die, but we're not going to implement this. And so the system works. It's much more compassionate than what's written, but we have to have the difficult That's why the Torah says to listen to the authorities in your generation. Okay, there are. I obviously prepared enough for a much longer session, but maybe I will just finish off by reading this interesting text, text number 12, Shadal. On Rambam, Moses Maimonides, and sexuality. The verse in Exodus says that if you have taken a handmaiden, an ama, and then you marry her, she'era ksuta v'onata lo yigra, you're not allowed to withhold from her. So she'er is generally understood as meaning food. Ksuta means clothing, so you have to be sure to provide her with a respectable amount. You have to treat her nicely. You give her a respectable amount of food, a respectable amount of clothing, and onata. So onata is a difficult word here that has a number of different understandings, but the standard rabbinic understanding of this is the sexual responsibility of the husband towards his wife. And so he's married this woman. It's true he purchased her as like a slave, like a handmaiden, but you have to treat her like a wife, seems to be what the text is saying. At least that's how the rabbis understood the text. So Shadal begins by saying he thinks that the rabbinic interpretation of the text here is correct. And in the second line here, Holze amra Torah b'misha nasa tamato kal v'chomer b'misha nasa bat chorin. And certainly, you know, the Torah tells us this principle that a man has to worry about his wife's sexual needs. And it tells you that about this, like, second-class wife and wants us to learn a kal vachomer, like, you know, if this is true for somebody who you purchase as a handmaiden, then certainly it's true for a full-fledged wife. Shu chayav belo safek b'sheirak sutavo onata lefi she'ur mamono v'chochotav. That every husband is responsible for his wife's food, clothing, and sexual needs. And this depends, of course, on how much money he has and how strong he is. You know, the Torah couldn't give you the precise details of what it means of each one of these things, defining each one of these things, but the rabbis did. Read the Talmud, you'll find that the rabbis go into a discussion of this. And I'm just skipping a line or so. And if a husband is falls below the threshold of what the rabbis say that he ought to be doing, the wife can come and complain to a Jewish court. And then they'll look into the question and see whether his failure to fulfill his responsibility is because he's a bad guy, or because nebuch, that's all that he could do. He did the best that he could. And v'im posheahu, and if he's falling short of his obligations to his wife and he doesn't have an excuse, yitzavu alav latet lachuka o yishalchenu mibeto. A man will be given an ultimatum. Either you do what you're supposed to do for your wife or you divorce her. V'inei chazal v'chochmatam uv'tzidkatam ra'u ki ha'isha einena kli v'lo nivret l'to'elet ha'ish u'lahanato bilvad. The rabbis understood in their wisdom and in their righteousness that a woman isn't just a vessel. Now, he knows that word kli is actually in a famous rabbinic text, actually applied to a wife in one text. But he's saying that isn't really what the rabbis think of the relationship between a husband and a wife. The woman is not just a vessel. And she was not created only for the enjoyment of a man and for his benefit. Aval ish v'ishto, here's this proto-feminist in the beginning of the 19th century. So nice to see. Aval ish v'ishto shnei shutafim. A man and a wife are two partners. Hitchabru birtzonam la'azor ish et reyehu ba'ava v'achva. They've come together to help each other with love, with mutual love. They're trying to help each other. V'lo levad hishgichu shelo yeh ha'ish korea chok ishto. And it's not just that they said that the husband has to worry about what the wife has coming to her. Aval hishgichu gam ala pratim hayoter kalim. The rabbis got into the nitty-gritty of what this actually means, that a husband should be worrying about his wife. Livilti yeh ha'ish korea hana'at ishto, that a man should not do anything that will lessen his wife's enjoyment, meaning, in this context, her sexual enjoyment. Kegon, he just alludes to a couple of Talmudic texts. Kegon imamar hu bevigdo vehi bevigda. The guy says, I don't want to take off my clothes. I want to have sexual activity without taking off my clothes. It's understood that the assumption here is that a woman does not find that attractive, and a man's not allowed to say something like that. Uman nichbad ma'amaram bischar shemashin atzmam. And look at that wonderful statement of the rabbis that it is that men are rewarded for waiting and for not rushing, meaning rushing through a sexual act. V'hefach mize, okay, so here now, it's just been a general statement about sexuality, and now he tells you actually what he's thinking about it as he's writing this text. V'hine hefach mize mitzad achad derech hanevalim she'enam mevakshim rak hana'at atzmam ve'im meshotetim tamid levakesh zima u'nesheihem nimasot b'eneihem v'yoshvot agvonot almanot chayot. And so this comes to exclude two classes of people. Class number one of people are the men who totally ignore their wives and just go around looking for prostitutes or looking for a promiscuous lifestyle. There's obviously the rabbis are trying to tell you shouldn't be from that class of people. V'hefech mizeh mitzad acher, and the other group that the rabbis are trying to tell you shouldn't be like, Darkei hamitchakmim, these people who think that they're so smart. We're going to see who this is in a second. Well, I wrote at the top here. It's the Rambam. Asher ha'ishahu lahem kishivcha l'shartam. These men who think that a wife is like a servant to serve her husband. Uchesam lishmirat briyutam. That a woman is there to serve as a kind of a drug, a medicine to keep the men healthy. And the man will be healthy if he has a wife to satisfy him from time to time. And then he puts in brackets a quotation from the Rambam, Lo yivol elak sheimtza gufo bari v'chazak biyoter. Rambam, the Rambam's suggestion that a man should have sexual activity only when he needs to have sexual activity. And he finishes off this text by saying, Aval misha torato hi torat Moshe va mishnah va talmud. But the person who establishes his sexual ethics by looking at Moshe Rabbeinu, looking at the Torah, looking at the Mishnah and the Talmud, he's not going to be like that. Hu ohev et ishto kegufo umechabda yoter migufo ba'alav ha'katuv omer v'yadata ki shalom Ohalecha. A person who follows true Jewish sexual ethics will love his wife as much as he loves himself, and he will respect his wife more than he respects himself, which is a quotation from the Talmud. This is not the only example of a text where Shaddal lays into Rambam. And Shaddal, although he was a student of philosophy, And there's a 3-page long in English. I translated this actually for another class that I teach. I translated this long section of Shaddal on Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5, where he tells you about his attitude to philosophy and his attitude to Judaism. And he explains that he likes philosophy and he likes Judaism. And he thinks that it's really important to study philosophy and to study Judaism, but not to say that they're the same thing as each other, and that you wreck Judaism by trying to make Judaism fit with Aristotelian or Neoplatonic philosophy. That isn't what Judaism is, and that one should study philosophy, but one should realize that it's something separate from Judaism. And both of these things can help your neshama. They can be of value to you as a human being as long as you keep them separate from each other. Dr. Nussbaum, that might be why they liked it at the Yeshiva University, because both of them are of value. But you know, one of the complaints that people occasionally have about Yeshiva University is that it puts the two worlds into two different silos, and it doesn't bring them together with each other. But Shaddal makes a strong commercial for the wisdom of doing that. You can see that he was he had a certain cantankerousness to him, and he was, you know, attacking various people here and there. At the bottom of I won't read the text here, but he goes ballistic against Ibn Ezra at the bottom of this page. So he didn't like Jewish mysticism. He didn't like Jewish philosophers, but he did like philosophy. But he was someone who, I think, took Judaism, took halakha, and took modernity very seriously, and was unwilling to just say one of them has to just like get out of the way and just ignore modernity and just live the standard halakhic life as if modern times don't exist. There are a number of modern values that are showing up in these texts, but he's not willing to go along with Reform Judaism. He feels that the commitment to halakha is crucial, and I think maybe you know now why I like Shaddal's commentary on the Torah, and I'm happy to answer any questions or hear any comments that people might have. Please. I think, according to Shaddal, according to Ibn Ezra, that's really an interesting question according to Ibn Ezra. And one of the common theories about Ibn Ezra these days, you may not have been asking this, but I'll answer it anyways, is that Ibn Ezra wasn't that much of a Talmudist. And Professor Simon, who I mentioned before, who just wrote the book about Ibn Ezra, claims that when Ibn Ezra was young, he received a good kind of Spanish-Jewish education, which consisted of studying the Rif, studying Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, and there were a lot of people in Spain who never studied the Babylonian Talmud, but studied the Rif, where they would learn what the halachot were, but all of the back and forth of the Talmud and all of the Agadata, they didn't bother learning. Shaddal had a very good Talmudic education, and I think that he would say that the things that look like they're interpretation, biblical interpretation in the Talmud, they're really just legislation. And it's dressed up as biblical interpretation, but it's legislation, and it was legislation made by brilliant Jewish people whose opinions I, Shaddal, want to follow. I want to do what the rabbis said in the Talmud that I should be doing, but not because their interpretation of the biblical text is the interpretation of the biblical text. It isn't, but they dressed up their legislation as interpretation of the text.
And so much of the dialogue is just trying to, you know, like this one says, but what do you do with this word? And they go on for pages and
That's right. You're offering a fine criticism of Chadal's. When you read it, it really looks like they're taking themselves very seriously as biblical interpreters. I think that Chadal just feels that he can't take them seriously as biblical interpreters, but he can take them seriously as legislators, and so he's more comfortable with that, even though it means ignoring the fact. You're absolutely right. In the Talmud, you know, it's, what are you going to do with this vav? What are you going to do with that? So, you know, why is this written chaser and male with a vav, without a vav? It's a fine criticism of his approach. Yes. I think that his teaching was in his rabbinical school, and one of the beautiful things in his commentaries on the Torah and in other books is that he's quoting his students all the time. You know, he says, you know, here's how I interpreted, and then my student Yitzhak so-and-so offered the following interpretation. I like this interpretation. I've always admired teachers who do that and give proper kavod to their students. It's true he was the head of a rabbinical school, and this sounds like a little bit radical for the head of a rabbinical school, but it's Italy, and in Italy there are different standards than in other countries. For many years, for many generations, there was much more openness in Italy over the years than there was in the rest of Europe. And so I don't think that within Italy he was seen as being problematic, but, you know, with people reading his stuff in Poland and in places like that, may not have enjoyed reading his works. Yes. 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 He definitely did believe that that Isaiah, the beginning of chapter 40, is a second. There's a second author. There's a great story about that Mark Shapiro wrote in one of his books. I heard from him afterwards that somebody told him that the story isn't true, but he still insists that the story is true. That when Rabbi Belkin finished his term as the president of Yeshiva University, one of the candidates who was being considered, Rav Soloveitchik, Zichrono Livracha, did not want him to be considered, and he told the rabbis in the yeshiva that they all had to oppose the candidacy of Rabbi so-and-so. And one of the rabbis turned to Rabbi Soloveitchik and said, what's wrong with this guy? And he said, he believes that Isaiah from chapter 40 and on were written by a second author. And the story is that this rabbi turned to Rabbi Soloveitchik and said, but Abarbanel says that. He could have said, and Chadal says it too. And Rav Soloveitchik supposedly said, Abarbanel can't be the president of Yeshiva University either. So you are right that is a red flag for a number of people. And but in Washington Heights, yes. Yes, yeah, but we're a lot more from, you know, Rabbi Kelvin, we're a lot more from here than they were over there. Yes, we've advanced. Yes.
In his discussion of the husband-wife relationship, do you think he was specifically going
very good. I had not thought about that. That sounds very possible. That you know, that with Hirsch looking more positively at Rambam's kind of approach, and Chagall, the Italian again, you know, taking a different attitude to these kinds of issues.